All right. Well, if you are new with us or if you're returning, regardless of how much you know, we are in the book of Ruth, and we have been in the book of Ruth for a couple of weeks now. The book of Ruth it's been really fun for me to get involved in because I just left Daniel and Revelation. And so it's been a blast to get in a book that's actually like a story. To be honest with you, I needed something easier to teach. And so this has been something I've been thankful for because it's been a blessing. But even in the midst of it being a book that's been easier to teach, I've actually found out that it's been a book that has incredible depth and a lot of life lessons that are unbelievable whenever you want to follow God, whenever you want to follow Jesus, and you want to display what it's like to love others the way that Christ loved the church. And I actually think that Ruth does that. Ruth, for those of you who don't know, this story takes place during the time of Judges. And the most famous line from the time of Judges is that everyone did what was right in their own eyes. Well, I think the book of Ruth is that Ruth did what was right in everyone's eyes. It's the way she stood out. And it was important for her to do it that way because when the author writes Ruth, I think it's supposed to be written at the end of Judges purposely. I mean, you get through Judges and it gets worse and worse and worse and worse. And the person that reads that thinks, where is God in the midst of all of this? And they get to Ruth and they see that this story that probably takes place right in the middle of the book of Judges, that God was there the whole time, and this is the way he was navigating a disobedient nation to make and keep his promises known to the people. And so he uses Ruth in the story of Ruth. However, in the story of Ruth, I actually don't think it's about Ruth. I think it's about Naomi. And the reason being is because Naomi's the one that makes the emotional change. It starts with her and her tragedy and ends with her and her joy. And I think it's about God fulfilling a promise. And check this out. This is how God works. In a time where we're going through a series on hope, I think Ruth probably provides the steps for someone to leave in despair and walking in hope better than any other book in the Bible just about. I think it's amazing. And so I broke down Ruth in a way that I think that you will never be able to forget it. You ready? This is the way it works. I think Book of Ruth is about Naomi. And so, to remember the Book of Ruth, I think you have to remember the name Naomi. And the way you remember it is like this. Nay. Oh. Me? Let's try that again. Nay. Oh. Me? That's the way the book of Ruth is written. The first chapter, it's a whole bunch of nay. In Bulgarian, no means nay. And so you say nay. Also, there's a N-E-I-G-H, Old English, nay. And so that also means no. And so it's negative. So when you start reading through the first chapter, you hear that Naomi and her husband, there's a famine in the land. Nay, that's terrible. Then you get, they leave Bethlehem and they walk over to Moab. They're like, nay. And not only that, but the father dies and they're like, nay. Oh, that's terrible. Elimelech died. And then the sons marry Moabite women. Do you know how Moabite women were created? I mean, the country of Moabites was one of those that you just didn't want to be affiliated with. And you go, nay, oh, nay. And then the sons die. And you think, nay. Is anything ever going to go well for Naomi? And she decides that she's going to leave and her two daughters with her. And as they walk towards the Dead Sea, they're standing on the cliffs looking over the Dead Sea, looking towards the Promised Land. And she says, what am I doing? I have nothing to offer these women. And she tells Orpah, which is a beautiful name, and Ruth, why don't y'all leave and go back and find men? I can't bear any sons with you. Nay, I can't do anything for you. And they both say, nay, no, we're going to stay with you. And then she begs them. She's like, I have nothing to offer you. And I won't think anything bad about you. You can still go back as you're young and find men that will provide for you sons that can take care of you. And so Orpah leaves, which her name actually means back of the neck. And I think she gets that from this right here. So we don't actually know her real name, in my opinion. But Ruth, who means I forgot what Ruth means. Friend, right? It means friend. And so she stays with Naomi. And the best nay in the whole first chapter is when Naomi turns to Ruth and says, no, you've got to go back. I have nothing to offer you. And she says, nay, you will not talk to me like that anymore. Don't encourage me. I'm going to be with you. And then she talks in Hebrew caveman language where she says, what? She says, You go, I go. You stay, I stay. You people, my people. Your God, my God. She makes it as clear as possible so you can't mistake any word that's in there. And she and so then they don't talk about it again. And she just walks with Naomi and she's by her side. And when you have someone that's in incredible despair like Naomi that has no hope at all, sometimes the best thing you can do as a person is you just walk with them until they're ready. And you know what? Sometimes they don't have the best ideas at that time. That doesn't mean you concede to do everything that they want to do, but you're there with them along for the journey. And you don't leave them. It's not time to correct Naomi, her thinking. It's time to be with Naomi. And that's what Ruth does. And so in a time where everyone did what was right in their own eyes, Ruth did what was right in everyone's eyes. And she walks with Naomi. They walk into the town and then they say, oh, it's Naomi. She's back. And she says, nay, don't call me Naomi. You call me bitter. You call me Mara because God has dealt with me oh so harshly. And Ruth is there with her. They live in the land. Next day, Ruth wakes up. She has an idea. Naomi doesn't have any ideas. She doesn't have room for ideas. And so she suggests something. She gets up and she says, you know what? I'm going to go out and glean in the field so that we can have food. She says, I'm going to go grocery shopping. But first I have to beg for money so that I can go grocery shopping so we'll have food. That's what she says to her. And Naomi's like, okay, go do that. It's the first time that Naomi says, okay, let's do that. So her attitude changes a little bit. Oh, okay. Why don't you go do that? And it just so happens, and there's that word form, right? It's by the chanciest of chancedness or the luckiest of Luckenstein. It's by happenstance. They just happened to go into a field where they had a relative that owned the land named Boaz. And Boaz was this great upstanding man. And when he shows up while she's out there gleaning in the fields, he's like, the Lord be with you and also with you. So early on, you know, Boaz not only is wealthy and has land and is able to take care of his people, but he also follows God and he wants to greet everybody with God. So he's a faithful man. And she ends up gleaning all morning. And Boaz asks, he says, oh, who is this lady? And they're like, well, actually, she's known by her reputation. She walked with Naomi all the way back here. And she's pretty studly of a woman. So we think we're going to keep her around. We're not going to run her off or anything like that. And he says, oh, maybe we should take care of her. And he says, why don't you just, you know, why don't you just toss a little bit more grain out for her? You know, let her pick up a little bit. Then they go off to lunch. Boaz goes to her first. And he goes to her and says, hey, listen, I know you're a Moabite woman, but our men actually drew some water. Why don't you drink some of the water with them? Which is a big, big deal. Because at that time, women actually drew water for the men. Foreigners typically drew the water for the Israelites. And when he says, why don't you take in water that the men drew, he's including her into the group. And Ruth has to go, oh, something's changing here. And that's where we are. So we are in the second chapter. We finished verse 13 last week, which is, Ruth's response to that situation is, may I continue to find favor in your eyes, my Lord, she said. You have put me at ease by speaking kindly to your servant, though I do not have standing of one of your servants. She is blown away right there. Verse 14. Well, Boaz, being a good landowner, provides a meal for all of his people, his workers. And so verse 14, at mealtime, Boaz said to her, he says, why don't you come over here and have some bread and dip it in the wine and vinegar? When she sat down with the harvesters, he offered her some roasted grain. She ate all she wanted and had some left over. So she had a to-go plate. As she got up to glean, Boaz gave orders to his men, let her gather among the sheaves. Don't reprimand her. Even pull out some stalks for her from the bundles you've already collected and leave them around for her to pick up and do not rebuke her. All right. Listen, when he includes her, a Moabite woman, remind you, that is just gleaning among the land, this is above and beyond what the Levitical practice issued. Remember, the Levitical practice was that you would leave the corners, the edges, and you don't go back and pick up what you left on the ground. You keep walking forward. And the foreigners and the poor and other people that are trying to collect for their family can come in behind them and pick up and gather whatever's left over. Boaz doesn't just leave down there everything, but he also says, hey, we're taking a break now. Why don't you come and eat with us? So he's providing her a meal as someone that's an equal. All right. Now, At minimum, the Israelites that were faithful did this out of hospitality. You are supposed to be hospitable so that other people would know that there's a God who blesses them. And so therefore, part of their blessing to others was to provide for them by just allowing them to come and eat. So this is a big, big move. At maximum, what meals together were supposed to mean was that they carried a symbolic reference to divine truths. Like God put festivals and meals in Scripture early on when He created His people, the Israelites, because He wanted them to interact together with hospitality and giving so they could recognize who God is. And so part of a faithful Israelite's life was that when they shared meals together, there was recognition that this was from God. That's what Boaz was inviting Ruth into when he brings her in. And he provides her so much that she has a to-go plate. So there's aluminum foil at this time, believe it or not. He says, come near. She is a foreigner and would typically eat separately. Or maybe she was just resting and not expected to eat. But he says, come near, join us. Even when the church was created, Paul returns back to Jerusalem and he sees Peter, one of the people that walked with Jesus for years, separated from the Gentiles, eating with just the Jewish people. And he rebukes him. And this is Peter. That's in Galatians, first chapter, run into the second chapter. Right here, you have Boaz, before Jesus had even walked the earth, demonstrating exactly what God wanted to do through his practice. So you're picking up a little bit of reputation. Not only does Ruth have a good reputation, but Boaz does too. And then on the menu is bread and vinegar and parched grain. It's not this great meal, but it's a good meal. In fact, if you ever go to Jerusalem, you have the opportunity to buy bread in Jerusalem. And I didn't know this, but people that are Jewish people get angry if you go to Jerusalem and don't buy bread at least once. They want to show off their bread. They want to show off their grain because it's actually still considered some sort of symbolic reference. And so when we walked through Jerusalem last October, and it was the last day, and I was asked by one of our guides if I had bought bread yet, and I said, no, I hadn't tried it. I'm telling you, I got a little bit of a mouthful from this lady, and she told me, go back and buy some. So Troy and I walked down, and we bought a loaf of bread, and we ate as much as we could, and then we kind of, you know, carried the rest and figured out another place. It's good. It's delicious. But it means something to them, is my point. It means more than just bread. This is not your Kroger. This is not your Albertsons bread. This is what is made that recognizes it's a gift from God, because it's grown from their land, which is promised to them. There's meaning to it. That's depth. Boaz offers this. Not to mention the reason that she left the land originally, Naomi, was because there was famine in the land. So don't miss the fact that there's so much bread she's able to glean and she's able to be fed that day. All right? Verse 17. So Ruth gleaned in the field until evening. Then she threshed the barley she had gathered, and it amounted to about an ephah. Now, let me clarify what ephah is to you. Ephah, it's about the size of a bath. That didn't clarify it? It's around the weight of a homer, which is the weight that a donkey could carry. All right? 1/10 of a homer is an ephah. So we're guessing it's somewhere around 30 to 40 pounds of grain in a sack. All right? So that's what she walks away with after she tosses and she beats out the grain and she gets just the seeds and the good stuff and she gathers it together. It's about 30 pounds at maximum. Could be anywhere between 17 to 30 pounds is what they're thinking, which is still a lot of grain. That'll last a little over a week. So she went grocery shopping that morning, came back with a week's worth of groceries. That's about like an American. So that's good. What she did was she gleaned so much compared to what she had just had in the Moabite desert. You see that God's favor is with her. And when earlier Naomi actually prayed for her in the first chapter, and here God is already providing for it. The other thing I don't want you to miss is that she went from position to different position throughout the day. In the morning, what would happen? Remember, I told you last week, if you were here, you had the reapers that would knock down the grain. Then you had the gatherers, which were women also, that would gather up in bundles and they put it in sacks and carry it along, right? There were possibly carts along with them that they would put it on the cart as it was pulled along. Then you would have the gleaners, which were the third line, and they got to pick up whatever was left, right? Well, throughout the day, she went from being back there to being up with the women to what you're going to see at the end of this chapter, that she's actually getting some of the first that's coming off. In her first day of work, she got two promotions. That's a pretty good day's of work. Not only did she got free meal, but she got two promotions. We would all love two promotions in a day's work. Let's see if there's anything else I can share with you. Yeah, this is not a normal gleaning situation. This is investing in the mid-90s in the Silicon Valley right now. I mean, this everything's going to work out. Somebody's buying something from you. So it works really well. Let's keep going. Verse 18. She carried it back to town, and her mother-in-law saw how much she had gathered. Oh, that's what you say right there, right? We're in the O section. Oh. Ruth also brought out and gave to her what she had left over that she had eaten that day. She shared her to-go plate. And Naomi thought, oh, I don't even have to cook this. This is nice, right? And then her mother-in-law asked, where did you glean today? But that's not enough of a question. Where did you work? And blessed be the man who took notice of you. Then Ruth told her mother-in-law about the one whose place she had been working. The name of the man I worked with today is Boaz, she said. And Naomi says, oh, well, the Lord bless him. Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, he has not stopped showing his kindness to the living and the dead, she added. That man is our close relative. He is one of our guardian redeemers. Hint, hint. He is one of the people that can step up and actually purchase what we've lost and give it back so that our heritage and our name will carry on. That's the name of Elimelech. That's the name of Mahlon, who is her husband as well. And so he's one of those people. We're going to talk about that section specifically when we get to the guardian redeemer here in a minute. Then Ruth the Moabite said, he even said to me, stay with my workers until they finished harvesting all my grain. And that's how we know that she scooted up, because the word she uses right there when she says, stay with my workers, she says the men. So not only did she come up to the women and walk parallel with them, but she got to actually grab it as they were coming off the reaping. So she got the fresh stuff, the good stuff, not the day old stuff, or the stuff that people might have walked over. Naomi said to her, to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, it will be good for you, my daughter, to go with women who work for him, because in someone else's field, you might be harmed. That's how we know that line earlier, that was one of the things that Boaz had said to his workers early on when he first saw Naomi, or Ruth, gleaning. He said, hey, make sure the workers, the male workers with the sickles, make sure you look out for her and take care of her. And then you had this statement by Naomi where she says, hey, it's good for you to be with the women and not gleaning behind. I didn't find any good warning passages of gleaners and what that's like, but I imagine what would happen is that there would be people that are walking the field after the harvesters have harvested. In fact, I don't think every situation where a foreigner is gleaning on the field is probably a good relation situation with the workers that are on the field. They probably had to glean a lot further back than getting close. They probably get yelled out on most fields. But Boaz wasn't one of those people. He wanted to look out for the foreigners as well, and those people, especially like Ruth, that showed such great loyalty to his family. And so what you have here is you have a situation where those people that were probably pushed back on the field, they were probably susceptible to men coming up and probably stealing all the grain at the end of the day, knocking down the women, taking their grain for stuff that they didn't even do. At maximum, there's probably even some danger just because they're women and there's men around that were evil and bad. And so the fact that she brings this up, she says, that's really great that he would allow you to work up there with the women as well and not be pushed back and possibly attacked. Verse 23, so Ruth stayed close to the women of Boaz to glean until the barley of the wheat harvest were finished, and she lived with her mother-in-law. So the second chapter ends way different than the first chapter starts. She has food, she has a job, she's got a promotion, and there's hope in Naomi finally, a lady that had no hope earlier. It says that she gleaned the rest of the wheat harvest and barley harvest. Well, that started in mid to late April, and it went all the way to the very end of May and might have spilled over into June. So we know she did this for about a month and a half. The kinsman redeemer that we were talking about earlier, what does that mean? Well, in Leviticus 25, there were these people called kinsman redeemers, and they were family members. And the law allowed a person, this is during the chapter on the year of Jubilee, and they allowed a person that was a relative of maybe someone that was poor or maybe someone that was sold into slavery to go back and redeem their family members after a period of time. Or they had the right and they had the possibility to do that. And so when Naomi uses this word here, she isn't necessarily thinking marriage like that. She's thinking, oh, maybe he can purchase Elimelech's property for us again so that we can actually pass that down or at least have something for ourselves. And so that's what's used right here. The first kinsman redeemer you really see is when Abraham goes off and he rescues Lot, when Lot is attacked by three different kings, and he goes and saves him. He was performing the act of a kinsman redeemer before that law was even established. And I think that a kinsman redeemer points to what Christ did for us on the cross.
The word goel, I did a study on it. It's the blood avenger, same word is translated blood avenger, as is the guy who buys the property or marries his brother's wife. And that does point to Jesus, because Jesus is our kinsman redeemer, but he's also coming back to execute judgment on the murderers of his blood.
Yeah.
So with the same word, the responsibility of a kinsman, of a goel, was to be somebody who carried the burdens of family, which included justice for murder,
yep,
as well as taking care of your, you know, raising up children for your brothers through their wives, and not buying their land and making sure that these things did not become lost to that family forever.
Yeah. Well, thanks. There's other notes on there other than goel. I had hesed. Actually, you did a really good job of explaining that. It does point to what Jesus did on the cross, that not only did he reclaim for us the promised land for us, but he also reclaimed for us our lives through offering his life as the blood sacrifice, which was wrongly taken, by the way, but rightly given by God. Thank you for that. Actually, my notes weren't as clear as your description, so thank you. Sometimes God does that, right? So you finish the first chapter on O, but the third chapter is a continuation of this O section, but it turns into a me section, which I like a lot, and I'm going to show you where that happens. All right, chapter 3, verse 1. One day Ruth's mother-in-law, sometime during this month and a half, Naomi said to her, probably at the end of this month and a half, my daughter, I must find a home for you where you will be provided for. By the way, this is Naomi's first good idea. It's the first time you know she has life. You know that she has something to offer. She actually has hope. She feels it. And guess what? It was only done because Ruth initiated not only the relationship, I will not leave you, I will adopt your life, I will follow your God. I think that's a public declaration of faith that your God is my God, that God of Israel is her God. And then what she does for someone that's in deep despair, she doesn't wait for her ideas, she goes out and does stuff. I think I mentioned this last week, but it's worth reminding you that when someone's going through something that's very hard and you say something like that's well-intentioned and you say, you know what, if you need anything, just let me know, that's adding extra stress to their life. because you're making them look at their life and identify what it is they could need help with. And then they're trying to think, man, I don't want to put someone out with those type of suggestions. I'm not sure. Not only that, but they aren't even thinking about their daily life. They're thinking about their mourning and their hurt. And it's hard for them to do it. The best way to care for someone during these times where they're in this deep despair like that is just to pick something and do it. You just knock on the door and say, hey, I don't know what you've got set up, but I'm here to mow your grass and I'm going to mow it until for the next 2 months. You don't have to worry about that. I'll be by once a week. Those type of actions are the ones that I hear about typically that are the ones that do a lot for people. Being with people when they're hurt and just being there regardless of what's going on. You don't even have to talk to them like Ruth didn't. And going out and initiating because you see a need and you're feeling a need. To care for someone in deep despair, possibly depression, where they can't get out of it, the best thing you can do is just help their needs. But when they start getting out of it, you see the hope that comes alive in them. And I think Ruth does a great job of helping Naomi get to a place where she probably experienced healing quicker than she would have on her own. So she offers a suggestion. You know what? I got to do something for you now. You've done a lot for me, is what she says. She's no longer hopeless. Now, Boaz, with whose women you have worked, he's actually a relative of ours. And tonight he'll be winnowing barley on the threshing floor. The threshing floor. All right. So, we've got Bethlehem that's probably up on a hill somewhere, right? If you go to Bethlehem today, you will see where Bethlehem is. It's up on a hill and you have to go up. Then there are these valleys down here. And there's all sorts of other hills in this area, okay? Well, the threshing floor is probably on one of the lower hills where wind can get to. And it's a large concrete circle that it almost looks like a really nice little patio. All right, so there's these stones that are laid out. It's hard. It's up on a hill, and there's walls that go around it a little bit. They're probably like a foot high or something to keep the grain in whenever the wind blows, but it allows the wind to blow through it. And so this is a windy area that's here, and it has really pretty patio stones. Some of them are still there today. And the process of the threshing floor works like this. What would happen is someone would go down with all of their grain that's been bundled up, and there's still chaff on it. And the chaff dries up after it's been cut from the ground, right? And when it dries up, it becomes brittle, and it can break off and be blown in the wind. But the problem is you got to get all the grain away. And so at minimum, I've used minimum a lot this morning, it's fun. At minimum, what they would do is they would toss it in the air and hit it with these forks. So they hit it, break it up, and then toss it in there, let the wind take it, and the grain would fall in that patio area that they could rake up. But a really fancy way of doing it is they would get these donkeys and they would have them walk around on those grains with a wooden plank behind it that worked like a grate. If you've ever been to a baseball game and you've seen them rake the dirt with four-wheelers, that's what they're doing. So they're running over it to break the grain, break the shaft, and then someone would toss it in the air. And it would make a faster or an expedited way of doing it. And if you had donkey and a trailer like that, you could probably get through some grain by yourself pretty quickly. I think that's what Boaz does right here. I think he's clearly a wealthy guy. I'm guessing he has a donkey or two. He might even have some help raking it up before he does it. But what you would do is if you had so much, you would actually have to sleep there like if you sold fireworks in a tent. You have to sleep there so that no one would come off and steal it. So this is what I think Boaz is doing. At the end of the barley festival, he's going through all his dry grains. He's tossing it in the air. He's breaking the shaft. And he has so much, he's got to stay there overnight. Typically, someone doesn't own this. Like there would be one, two, maybe per city that everybody that was a farmer would use. And it's probably not on his land. So it's probably away from his field and away from the city. And so it's a lonely place probably at this time. But I'm guessing Boaz liked that place a lot because if you are responsible for a lot of people, I found out getting away is a nice thing to do. All right, you ready? Verse 3. Here is Naomi's suggestion. Wash, put on perfume, get dressed in your best clothes, then go down to the threshing floor. But don't let him know where you are until he has finished eating and drinking. When he lies down, note the place where he's lying. Then go uncover his feet, lie down, and he will tell you what to do. Verse 5, "I will do whatever you say," Ruth answered. So she went down to the threshing floor and did everything her mother-in-law told her. Surprising note. Naomi, described as the one who does what's right in everyone's eyes in a time where everybody did what was right in their own eyes, right? This is the first time she's obedient and listens to Naomi. Surprise! She wasn't necessarily listening to what she was saying earlier because she was in so much trauma. But now that their hope is alive and Naomi's in a place where she can care for her and be a great mother-in-law, guess what? She goes and does this. Now, if you were to turn to, which one do I want to go to? 2 Samuel 12:20. You will find a story about David. David and Bathsheba, actually, is the story. And out of that union came a pregnancy. And God had sent Nathan, who was a prophet, that said that the baby would die. Or said that he would be judged, I'm sorry. And then the baby was born, and it was very sick. And David put on his mourning clothes, covered his head with ashes, put on sackcloth, took off his regular clothes, and he wailed, he would not eat, and he would cry out to the Lord. At the end of that time, when the child passed away, the very thing that David did was the very description that happens that Naomi suggests Ruth does. Go wash. Let's see. Actually, I'm going to read it to you. Verse 20. Then David got up from the ground after he had washed, put on lotions, changed his clothes, and he went into the house of the Lord and worshiped. Then he went to his own house, and at his request, they served him food, and he ate there. Here's what I think Naomi said. The time for mourning is ended. It's time for you to go find a man. And Boaz is a good man. She suggests that you take off your mourning clothes and get properly dressed, which means Ruth was probably wearing her mourning clothes. And when Boaz walks up and he sees who this woman is that's gleaning, he probably recognized her somebody that was in mourning. And if he connected two and two together, then he would say, I bet she lost her husband. And so he inquires about her in chapter 2. He's probably wondering what has happened. And the story is, yes, she's lost her husband, but she is here helping Naomi, who also lost her husband. And it really hits Boaz deep. And so what I think Naomi is suggesting is, you know what? Our time of mourning is over. That's how I know she has hope again. And she's been pulled out of this despair that she's experienced. She also offers a couple of suggestions. Go down to the threshing floor, hide, and wait till he's done eating. After he's done stirring everything up, he's probably done for the night. He's taking a break. He's building his fire. He's cooking his bread. He's eating there, right? And it says eating and drinking. He probably had a couple glasses of wine. The expression is, wait till he feels merry, because then they'll be more receptive of what you might have to offer. There's a horrible story in Judges 19. Horrible story. But what happens is there's a man who lives up in Gibeah, and he has a concubine that he bought from Bethlehem. And one day, she gets mad at him, and she runs home to Bethlehem. And he goes down to Bethlehem to go retrieve his concubine. And when he shows up there, he stays the night with the family, and they welcome him in. And they say, why don't you stay another night? Have some more bread. You need your energy before you can make a long trek like that. And they give him bread and wine, and he's merry, and he suggests he stay the night, and he does. And then the next day, he's showing around the property, and he says, why don't you just stay another night? And he keeps making him, filling him, the words are the same here, wait till he eats and drinks and is merry, so he'll be more receptive to what's going on. And then after a while, he finally leaves because he said, I can't stay here anymore, because he was tricked into about a week's worth of staying to go grab his concubine. And so when he goes back, some horrible things happen. But the same phrase that's used there was the same phrase that's used during the same time period here. This is a good time for offering suggestions and bringing whatever your proposal is to him. and I use proposal purposefully there. She also says, uncover his feet and lie down. I'm going to share a little bit about that in a second. Verse 7, when Boaz had finished eating and drinking and was in good spirits, he went over to lie down at the far end of the grain pile to protect it, obviously, just like you would do if you were selling fireworks in a tent. You know that, right? They have to stay there the entire time they're selling fireworks. They can't leave the tent behind because people steal it. And so there's always someone staying in those tents. That's what Boaz is doing. Ruth approached quietly, uncovered his feet, and lay down. All right, uncovered his feet. The word there for uncovered his feet is actually a very uncommon word. And there's been many suggestions that uncovering the foot works the same way in the Hebrew that it would have worked with other sayings, because it can be used as a euphemism. That if you uncover the legs or uncover the feet, if you use the most common word, could mean uncover the private parts or the genitalia that would leave him susceptible, I guess, to something happening there. Well, actually, the word uses a very uncommon word. And that's why I think that the author that's writing this is using such an uncommon word for it to suggest that this is the exact opposite of what the euphemism is. Saying it was not something that was distasteful, or she wasn't trying to get him in bed necessarily. She was trying to stir him and wake him up is what she was trying to do. Not to mention, think logically about the location. We're at the threshing floor that's down the hill of the city, so it's far away. You probably can't see it very well. But it's a very windy area. So my guess is that he probably brought some blankets or something to keep himself warm at night, because he knew he was staying down there because he had so much to winnow and to thresh. And so he covers himself up. I think it's as innocent as she just uncovered his legs and his feet so he would get cold and stir. But then the innocence leaves just a little bit, because she, after uncovering the feet, it says, in the middle of the night, something startled the man. That phrase, in the middle of the night, typically means at midnight, at the darkest part of the night. So sometime between midnight and 3 a.m. is what that section of time means. It's used in other parts of Scripture, like when the angel came through in the middle of the night and killed the firstborn child in Israel. That's one of them that's used the same phrase right there. Also, when Jacob wrestled the angel of the Lord, it was in the middle of the night. So that's what happened. Also, it says, in the middle of the night, something startled the man. He turned, and there was a woman lying at his feet. I don't think this is lying at the feet. I think she actually snuggled up by him a little bit, so that if he happened to stir because he was a little cold, then he would kick her, or he would hit her with his leg, and he'd find her, and he'd wake up. And this is the biggest O in this section. He wakes up, and he says, oh, there is a woman lying at my feet. And she just happens to be there. And he says, who are you? And she goes, I am Ruth. He goes, oh, okay. And then she suggests something which is fairly interesting. Spread the corner of your garment over me, since you are a guardian redeemer of our family. Does anybody have a different phrase in there? Spread the... we are in verse 9.
Spread therefore thy skirt over thine...
The skirt. Okay. Anybody have something different?
Wings.
Wings of an eagle. Okay. Those are the two. All right. So we have three possibilities. Is this a blanket garment, and it's used as a phrase that he has put over him? Is this his robe and she uncovered his legs and he's like, oh, and he flips it back over? Or the wings word, which is a very interesting phrase in and of itself. And all three are highly, highly, highly possible. If you wanted to, you could turn to Ezekiel 16, 8 through 12, but I'd rather you listen to it. This is the Lord of Israel saying what the way he picked his bride, which is Israel. This is God himself in Ezekiel 16, 8 through 12. He said, then I passed by you and looked, and lo, you were at the age of love. He talks about Israel with such intimacy. So I spread my skirt of my robe or my wings over you and covered your nakedness. I gave you an oath and entered into a covenant with you, says the Lord Yahweh, and you became mine. But the order's reversed. Then I bathed you. Remember, Ruth did that earlier. I bathed you with water. I washed you. I washed the blood from you. I put perfume oil upon you. I clothed you with embroidered dress and fine leather sandals. I dressed you in fine linen and covered you with sumptuous attire. I decked you out in jewelry. I put bracelets on your arm, a chain around your neck, a ring on your nose, earrings in your ear, and a lovely crown upon your head. He takes care of his. The phrase used is clearly and suggestively a proposal of marriage. And so not only is she suggesting the intimate union, not at that time necessarily, but it's a proposal for marriage. But she's also suggesting that you protect me, you take care of me, and you take me in as your own. For you are my guardian, kinsman, redeemer. She proposes to him. So, remember that Naomi said, whatever he tells you to do, you do it. In verse 10, he says, the Lord bless you, my daughter. He replied, oh, this kindness is greater than that which you showed earlier. And he uses the word hesed, which is the word for loving kindness of loyalty and devotion, which is the way God is described over and over again. You have not run after the younger men, whether rich or poor. And now, my daughter, don't be afraid. I will do for you all you ask. And all the people of my town know that you're a woman of noble character. Although it is true I am a guardian redeemer, oh, there is another man more closely than I. Oh, right? Stay here for the night. And in the morning, if he wants to do his duty as a guardian redeemer, good. Let him redeem you. But if he's not willing, as surely as the Lord lives, I will do it. Lie here until the morning. All right. Not exactly the yes that you would typically get at a proposal for marriage. And maybe slightly confusing and maybe slightly uh-oh, but there is some certainty in it that's really good. She is guaranteed to be taken care of. Either by this man who's a closer kinsman redeemer that has the right according to Leviticus 25, but even if he denies it, I promise I will, which is what Boaz offers. And you as a reader, as you read this, you think, oh, there's a little bit of hiccup in there because you've grown to love and respect Boaz. But now Boaz might be put in a weird situation and we might not know who Ruth's going to be with. And there's a little bit of uncertainty in there, even though there's certainty to the whole thing. And so, spread your bait over me or your wing or garment is one which Ruth desires from Boaz. And he says, I will if I'm the right one for you. We'll finish the rest of this story next week of Ruth. But what you see is you see a couple of interesting things. Number one, Naomi's prayer is already answered. She prays for a blessing for Ruth and for kindness to be given to her the same way she experienced it. Ruth gets that. Number two, I think this is huge for Boaz. Boaz, a man that's been faithful, been walking with the Lord, there's actually no reference to him having a wife or kids. We don't know. This might be the only one that he's ever had. And this is a proposal. And the man doesn't jump all over it right off the bat. He's faithful to the Lord and what he already laid out, which demonstrates the type of man he could be in the future. And then you've got Ruth. For the first time, Ruth listens to Naomi because she offers a suggestion. And when she does it, you've got this big O here. What's going to happen? There are going to be times in your life, this is where we'll end, where people of good Christian character are going to offer suggestions to you as a believer and as a follower that you might not wholly agree with. You might not even understand why you disagree with it. Or you do agree with it and you'll follow it, and it might not work out the way that you hoped. The interesting thing about this story, which we'll learn next week, is that God's got control of all these things. And even in the midst of saying yes to God, he doesn't always answer the how. In a lot of your Christian walk, a lot of your Christian walk, if you walk faithfully, you're going to come to a whole lot of O's in your life. Oh, that's not the way I thought it was going to work out. When I graduated seminary, I took a job in another church, a larger church. I thought larger church meant I'd have more opportunity, and I'd be able to learn a lot about how the church works, and possibly go out either plant a church or be a part of another church and help lead it after I learned what was going on there. After being there, I found out that their jobs are so specialized at churches that large that you don't, if you have multiple gifts, you don't get a chance to use all of them and develop them. In fact, sometimes they don't even know what that job requires, and you end up doing things that you would have never chosen. And even though you're walking faithfully, and you know that you're supposed to be a pastor like me, I came to a point where I thought, oh, this isn't what I thought I was supposed to do. And about the same time I came to that, oh, this is what I thought I was supposed to do, the church came to the, oh, we shouldn't have hired Kevin. That's a bad oh. they told me in May 1st, we had just found out we were pregnant with Lena, that I was going to be losing my job and they're going to be hiring somebody else for that position. And that time of, oh, became a stressful time. At the time, my wife wasn't working. We needed my insurance. We needed all that. They didn't even tell me how long I had at the church. In fact, I wasn't going to volunteer any kind of conversation where they told me I was going to leave. So I kind of avoided it, did my job, and I just faithfully thought, you know what? I'm just going to walk after God. I don't know what's going to come after this. In some of my prayer life, some of the times I was walking just faithfully day by day, not sure in what conversation I was going to have at that church. Every day became a sweet time with the Lord, sweeter than I was normally expecting. And sometimes our biggest blessings come in the midst of our greatest confusion of what's going on. That church was unbelievable to me. They paid me my regular salary and my insurance until I got my first paycheck at Grace Bible Church, which was 5.5 months later. I'm not saying that's what you should do. But I am saying that daily devotion and dependence on God is without a doubt a practice we should all have. And I hate the fact that I've forgotten that and I have to remind myself of it. And there's many times in my walk where I think, oh yeah, oh, I need to have devotion to God. It seems like Ruth never forgot that. I challenge us all to be like that.